Hello, I'm Curtis Bowers, and this is Agenda Weekly. Thank you so much for joining me again this week. I really appreciate it. Subscribers, thank you so much for being such a blessing to us. Those watching on Rumble, please like, share, and follow. Those listening on the different podcast platforms, please consider giving us a 5-star review if you appreciate the podcast. And also, all of you that watch on both of those platforms, consider going to agendaweekly.com. I think if you like these episodes that we do, you'll really like the news brief, the prayer and action items, and the other educational and informative resources we have each week to kind of help give you a good overview of everything going on without wasting your entire week to get that accomplished. The end of next week, I'm going to be going to El Salvador with some of my boys. And just to check that country out, I've been so intrigued by them and just the progress they've made by turning to God and say, we want you to be our God, and starting their parliament with prayer, and in 5 years being transformed from the most violent, unsafe place in the entire world, number one on the chart, to now almost the safest place in the entire world. But anyway, I'll try to do an episode from there, which will probably air the following week after that. But I want to check that out. It's just nice to know what's going on in other places, especially a place like that that's pretty close to America. You can fly there in about 2.5 hours for about $300 round trip, which is really nice. But I'll let you know more about that. Today, Alex Newman's going to talk with us about the intermediate step necessary for the New World Order. They've kind of realized over the last 40 years to get a global government, just to bring that about quickly, is impossible. They first need to work toward regional governments, regional control networks that start getting more and more control from the sovereign nations, and so that they can get the control they desire, but do it step by step. And he's going to show you a lot of their comments on them realizing that's what we need to do now for the New World Order that George H.W. Bush inspired everyone to pursue. But I think it'll be important information that you really need to know. But thank you so much for joining me today. Before I get to Alex, I'm going to answer just a few of your questions quickly. Katie and many of you had questions about Charlie Kirk. They had problems with, you know, he's supposedly the Man of Steel because a 30-odd-6 bullet bounced off his spine and went down into his body, which is impossible, and things like that, which it is disturbing. We are definitely being told a lie, and they're covering up something. When Tyler Robinson's gun was a 30-odd-6, a 30-odd-6 did not shoot Charlie Kirk, period. I'll get more into that. I'm kind of waiting for more evidence to come out, so I'm not just speculating the whole time. Sometime soon, I'll do a whole episode digging in to the facts of what we know for sure, what we're being told, and so what we know are lies. There's so many lies going around, but many of you had questions on that. But anyway, now to Alex Newman.
Hey guys, Alex Newman here. So honored to be with you again here on Agenda Weekly. Thank you so much, Curtis. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you guys. And I want to talk about something that I haven't spent as much time as I probably should, considering the significance of it. And that is the road to New World Order, One World Order, whatever you want to call it. Actually has an intermediate step. And a lot of us who are focused on stopping and exposing globalism don't pay enough attention to the interim step, which is absolutely essential to their final vision. And that is the destruction of national sovereignty in exchange for these horrible regional organizations that are now sprouting up all over the world. So I do want to spend some time talking about that today. I want to show you that it's happening all over the world. The European Union, of course, is the model, as we will see, but this same exact model is being imposed on the entire planet. So without further ado, let me get my PowerPoint ready, and then you guys can follow along with me as we go. I'm going to share screen, and we're going to take a look at regionalization on the road to world order. First, for the newer folks joining us who maybe haven't spent much time looking at this agenda for world order, I just want to start with a few of the things that are obviously happening on this push toward a one world political, economic, and even religious system that maybe we can talk about next month, God willing. But here's the President of the United States back in 1991 announcing where this was all going.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations. When we are successful, and we will be, we have a real chance at this new world order, an order in which a credible United Nations can use its peacekeeping role to fulfill the promise and vision of the UN's founders.
Now, a lot of you have probably seen that video. I use it frequently just to show kind of people who are just now starting to wake up or people who still haven't realized what's going on that, I mean, they've been telling us for decades that they plan to build a new world order, where, as Bush just said, you heard him, a credible United Nations, a kind of ultimate oxymoron, is going to use its peacekeeping role. He's talking about their military forces to implement the vision of the UN's founders. And of course, we know what the UN's founders believed. Here are some of the key players, obviously Joseph Stalin, his minion, the foreign secretary, the foreign affairs minister of the Soviet Union, Mr. Molotov. And then on our side, we sent Alger Hiss, who was the chairman of the conference that created the UN Charter. He was then the first Secretary General of the UN. Then we threw him in prison here in the United States because we found out he was a spy for Joseph Stalin. I don't want anybody to think it's a partisan thing, right? There are plenty of these people on record pledging allegiance to the new world order, the global system that they're talking about building. Here's Bill Clinton.
After 1989, President Bush kept said, and it's a phrase that I often use myself, that we needed a new world order.
And bringing it up to the modern era, Joe Biden.
The affirmative task we have now is to actually create a new world order.
And so I mentioned that a lot of these people were open from the very beginning, right? If you go back and you look at one of the key architects of the United Nations, his name was John Foster Dulles. He was Secretary of State during that time. He was also a co-founder of the Council on Foreign Relations, an incredibly powerful organization. We'll talk about them hopefully in an upcoming episode of Agenda Weekly. But he was a delegate to the UN General Assembly. He played a key role in writing the UN Charter. And then just a few years after the UN was born, he released a very interesting book called War or Peace, where he kind of laid out the whole agenda in really plain terminology. I mean, there was no beating around the bush. He said exactly what they were doing, which is amazing how many secrets they hide in their books in the library. I guess they figured nobody's reading, which they're only partly correct, right? Some of us do read. But he said in the book here, War or Peace, that the United Nations represents not a final stage in the development of world order, which whenever you see that word order, just substitute it for government and you understand exactly what they're talking about, as we'll see. But it's only a primitive stage. He says, therefore, its primary task, the primary task of the UN, he says, is to create the conditions which will make possible a more highly developed organization. Now, continuing, he says in this book, I've never seen any proposal made for collective security with teeth in it or for world government or for world federation, which could not be carried out either by the United Nations or under the United Nations Charter. So look right there, folks. He is telling you. You don't even have to, like, read through the lines, right, which sometimes you do with these people. He says right there, right, the existing UN Charter is perfectly adequate for building a world government, a world federation, okay, with teeth in it, which means with enforcement power. Now, I think they went back to the drawing board on that, and that's what we're going to spend most of our time today on, because I think they realized that they couldn't just hop into a one world government in one go. I mentioned the Council on Foreign Relations earlier. They have a magazine that is very, very important. It's called Foreign Affairs. One of the whistleblowers who defected from the CFR, Admiral Chester Ward. I have his book behind me. It's called Kissinger on the Couch, when he blew the whistle on these people. He said, if you want to know the policy of the U.S. government a couple years in advance, just read Foreign Affairs and you'll understand where it's going. And he explains even the mechanism through which, you know, they publish it in Foreign Affairs. And then what happens next is all the organs of power start moving in that direction. So with that context, with that backdrop, let's look at what this magazine published in 1974 in its April issue. It published a piece by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Richard Gardner. And in this book, or in this article, he says, in short, the House of World Order will have to be built from the bottom up rather than from the top down. An end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece, will accomplish much more than the old-fashioned assault. Couldn't be clearer, folks. Okay, we're going to erode your country's sovereignty piece by piece, rather than just marching in there one day and saying, "All right, everybody, your sovereignty is gone. You're now all part of a one-world government." Right? People wouldn't go for that. So they understood that they've got to do this piece by piece, eroding our national sovereignty. And that's exactly what they're doing. In fact, about a decade before that came out, the U.S. State Department hired a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, a longtime operative for the so-called intelligence community, to try to come up with a plan for reaching world government. And this report, it was commissioned again by the State Department, created by the Institute for Defense Analyses by Lincoln Bloomfield, published in 1962. It was called A World Effectively Controlled by the United Nations. And the goal of this report was to figure out, how do we get from where we are now, which was, you know, at that time still a world of relatively sovereign nation states, right? You could go back to the Treaty of Westphalia, you know, almost 400 years ago at that time. And it created a world order where basically the sovereign nation state was the primary actor on the world stage. And the goal of this report was, how do we get from that, where we are, to where we want to be, which is a world effectively controlled by the United Nations? And he proposes a few very important things. And one of the things he says is that war, or the threat of war, is the most effective catalyst for bringing this about. And of course, they knew from experience, right? World War I gave birth to the League of Nations. World War II gave birth to the UN and the IMF and the World Bank and, you know, all these institutions that we see of global governance. And also, by the way, World War II gave birth to the nucleus of what would become the European Union. We'll come back to that. And what he said in this report, Lincoln Bloomfield, one of the many things he said is that what was really needed to bring this about was ever larger units evolving through customs unions, confederations, regionalism, until ultimately the larger units coalesce under a global umbrella. Right. So you go from sovereign nation states to what? Customs unions, confederations, regional governments. And then once you have all the formerly sovereign nations of the world basically absorbed into these regional entities, if you will, then these regional entities coalesce together under a global umbrella. Okay, that's exactly, ladies and gentlemen, the process that's taking place now. Now, let's fast forward about 50 years. Henry Kissinger, who recently passed away, went to go meet his maker. I can't imagine that went very well for him, unless he, you know, hopefully repented and trusted in Christ before departing this life. But what he said in his 2014 book, World Order, there's that word again, was, and I'm quoting word for word here from his book, "The contemporary quest for world order will require a coherent strategy to establish a concept of order within the various regions and to relate these regional orders to one another." Okay, again, simple translation here. Whenever you see the word order, just substitute it for government. So the contemporary quest for world government will require a coherent strategy to establish a concept of government within the various regions and then to relate these regional governments to one another. So that's what we're going to look at today, folks. We're going to look at this process as it is happening in real time, almost entirely out of the spotlight. I mean, you're not reading about this in your local, you're not even reading about this or hearing about this from your alternative media, your conservative talk show host. And I think part of it is they don't know these things. They don't understand these things. You know, they're focused on the shiny object that the controlled opposition wants us focused on. They're not focused on the real process here of building this new world order. Here's Henry Kissinger, by the way, if you don't remember.
"When really a new world order can be created, it's a great opportunity."
Oh, yes, a great
There's
opportunity.
A need for new world order.
New world order, yes, a new world order. We have a new world order. Okay. So, even more recently, you might remember Klaus Schwab. And by the way, if you didn't know, Henry Kissinger recruited Klaus Schwab, and David Rockefeller recruited Henry Kissinger. So you have kind of the chain of command there. You've got...
I want to stop there for a minute. Henry Kissinger, as many of you know, was rotten to the core. And he had huge influence for evil and for dismantling America's strength and security worldwide. He loved war. The Vietnam War was his little pet project, killing, you know, over 55,000 of our boys for nothing, and on I could go. But he was a globalist, obviously, and he was working to create the New World Order. And he talked about it so often in his life. But he was the one that also set up the World Economic Forum and put Klaus Schwab in charge of that. And he also, another thing a lot of people don't know, he was the one that picked Benjamin Netanyahu when he was a young man and brought him to America as a young man, paid for his entire college education. And he knew that would be his disciple in the Middle East. That's one of the reasons I haven't liked Benjamin Netanyahu, for many reasons. He's a hardcore globalist. He hates the Jewish people. You can see by the policies he's implemented, like the Pfizer laboratory, of all the people being forced vaccinated and everything else. But he's another person that has a lot of influence on our world today that was just a student of Henry Kissinger, handpicked by him to be his representative in the Middle East. But many other top leaders too have been groomed by these globalists and then put into positions of power so they'll do what they're told.
And so Klaus Schwab, you might remember, during the height of the COVID pandemic, during the height of the COVID pandemic, Klaus Schwab brought his buddies together for the World Economic Forum to announce the Great Reset. And I've talked a lot about that. In fact, I was the first journalist in the United States to do a big expose on the Great Reset back in the summer of 2020. And a lot of this was based on Klaus Schwab's book, COVID-19, The Great Reset. The whole thing is worth reading if you want to understand their strategy. It's not that difficult to understand once you know what you're looking at. But I want to focus in particular on what he said about regionalism. Okay, he acknowledged that people were pretty upset with globalism, or globalization, as he calls it, because of, you know, China and the supply chains getting messed up. And, you know, people had a sense that, you know, maybe the globalism had contributed a little bit to this global pandemic. So he says that the most likely outcome along the globalization, no globalization continuum lies in an in-between solution. Notice he calls this a solution, right? Solution to what? Well, a solution to the problem of national sovereignty, of course, is what he means. And that solution, he says in this book, is regionalization. Notice he points to the European Union as the model. He says the success of the European Union as a free trade area, or the new regional comprehensive partnership in Asia, a proposed free trade agreement among the 10 countries that compose ASEAN, that's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, are important illustrative cases of how regionalization may well become a new watered down version of globalization. Okay. Plain English, folks, right? Regionalization is watered down globalism. And then he even talks about North America. We're going to spend some time on North America. He says even the three states that compose North America now trade more with each other than with China or Europe. In other words, North America could be a little union. And of course, that is exactly their plan. Now, shortly after Klaus Schwab let all this out in his book on the Great Reset, and of course, he was pushing for it big time through the corporate influence he had with the World Economic Forum, the CEO and the president of the Atlantic Council, a critical organization in the machinery moving us toward globalism, spoke about this very, very openly. So here he is at the World Government Summit. And yes, it's actually called the World Government Summit. I'm not making that up or trying to be funny. He's speaking at the World Government Summit on a panel. This is held in on the Arabian Peninsula. This is 2022. Listen carefully to what he says here.
China, I think in 2016-17, invested $53 billion in the United States. Last year, $1 billion. So there's already a decoupling. There's already a breaking down. And the question is, how does this play out right now? And so I think you're going to see, in an economic sense, you're going to see these two worlds, but it's not going to be that neat. I think you're going to see the evolution of regional organizations, and the regional, because it's so hard to create a world order, I think you're going to see regional orders spring up. And then you have links between regional orders, but they will be very much guided by economic interests, social interests, and also security interests. You see things like the Quad, like the Abraham Accords, so ad hoc, not inflexible alliances, and that seems to me what's emerging at the moment.
Yeah, and a lot of these people describe this as if they're just like observers, like, oh, we're just commenting on the fact that all over the world, people appear to have decided to surrender their national sovereignty to regional governments. But that's not what's happening here at all. Right? These are the people who are involved in directing this process. They are not casual observers commenting on an organic process. And all you really need to do is spend 2 seconds thinking about this to realize that, right? What are the odds that people in Russia, people in Germany, people in China, people in the Philippines, people in Thailand, people in India, people in Brazil, people in Argentina, people in Nicaragua, people in Belarus, people in Zimbabwe, all woke up one day and started clamoring to surrender their national sovereignty to a regional government, right? I think we all recognize that's self-evidently ludicrous. What's happening here is this is being imposed from the top down. And they're getting bolder and bolder, right? Here's a news article. This just came out a few months ago. This was in France 24. It's a piece from the Wire, the AFP, Agence France-Presse, the French newswire. And it's quoting the head of the IMF, who, by the way, has a long communist pedigree. Her original name was Stalina Georgieva, but when Stalin fell out of favor, her parents slapped Chris on the front. So now she's Kristalina Georgieva. Yes, she was actually named after Stalin. Not so fun fact. And so as the head of the IMF, she was, of course, a big advocate of the Great Reset. Here she is in this interview with them saying that countries, and by that she means governments, must make the best of the new multipolar world order. And listen to a little summary. You can read the article. It's very clear. They say countries, in other words, governments, have no choice but to make the best of the fragmentation of the global economy by boosting ties with regional and like-minded countries or governments, the head of the International Monetary Fund said in an interview Thursday. So they're telling you folks where they're going, right? Countries must. In other words, this isn't an optional thing. And multipolar world order, I should comment on this term. I first started seeing it about 15 years ago coming out of the Council on Foreign Relations. And so multipolar contrasts with the unipolar world order that we're kind of moving out of right now. And a lot of people commenting on this are not just, again, passive observers. They're orchestrating this process. And so the unipolar world order was dominated by the United States. It was the only single pole of power, right? So the United States dominated economically, militarily, diplomatically, in every way, right? The unchallengeable hegemon on this planet. All the governments in the world together couldn't have truly challenged the power of the United States. Well, that era is ending. We're watching the controlled demolition, at least we have been for a few years. There seems to be an effort to reverse that by the president, at least most of the time. And so we have been watching the controlled demolition of that unipolar world order, where they're deliberately sabotaging our economy. They're deliberately destroying our energy infrastructure. They're deliberately dumbing down our children, as we talked about last month, right here on Agenda Weekly. They are deliberately humiliating our military, right? They're promoting, at least they have been until recently, very grateful for some of the recent changes, but they've been deliberately promoting, people who are confused about their gender, people who like to wear dog masks and other weird, kinky, sexual things. They've been deliberately doing this to try to bring down the old unipolar world order and bring in this new multipolar world order. Well, now you will have multiple poles of power. So it won't just be Washington, D.C. It'll be Washington, D.C. and Berlin and Moscow and Johannesburg and Beijing and Shanghai and, all these world capitals of economic and government power will become kind of their own little unique poles, right? And each of these poles, by the way, you'll see as we get closer to the end, all revolve around one of these regional governing entities, right? So it's not going to be like the United States. It's going to be like the North American regional block. It'll be the Eurasian regional block. It'll be the African regional block, right? So we'll come back to that. Now, Zbigniew Brzezinski worked closely with David Rockefeller. He wrote an interesting book, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Age or Era, where he kind of praised Marxism, claimed the United States was obsolete. And he was very open on where this was all going, right? He talked about, Marxism being this further vital creative stage in the maturing of man's universal vision and so on and so forth. But he joined forces with David Rockefeller. They created the Trilateral Commission. And the Trilateral Commission is actually one of the major forces that's been promoting this regional governance approach. They talk about the new international economic order. And here's what Brzezinski had to say about this, right? I'm just going to quote him word for word. To sum up, though the the objective of shaping a community of the developed nations is less ambitious than the goal of world government, it is more attainable. It is more ambitious than the concept of an Atlantic community, but historically more relevant to the new spatial revolution. Though cognizant of present divisions between communist and non-communist nations, it attempts to create a new framework for international affairs, not by exploiting these divisions, but rather by striving to preserve and create openings for eventual reconciliation. So the goal here is regional government on the road to world government. Interestingly, Mikhail Gorbachev talked about this very thing in 1995 at the State of the World Forum. Here is what he had to say. We do not have a new world order. We cannot leap into world government in one quick step. In brief, the precondition for eventual globalization, genuine globalization, is progressive regionalization, because thereby we move toward larger, more stable, more cooperative units.
I went to a Gorbachev lecture once in Houston, Texas, and I was shocked. He was introduced at this forum, and there was thousands of people there, and they cheered like it was a rock concert or something. But he was introduced as the greatest man of the last 50 years in the entire world. This mass murdering thug who so destroyed the environment in the Soviet Union while he was the dictatorship. He slaughtered hundreds of college students. He left the Soviet Union to start Green Cross International in San Francisco immediately thereafter to save the environment. No, they knew world government was coming through the United Nations, through the climate crisis. They figured that out back in the 70s when they kind of captured that movement. And Gorbachev and so many of those people were just totalized their life, everything that they stood for.
Again, Zbigniew Brzezinski openly calling for regional government on the road to world order. Of course, he was a key player in the Jimmy Carter administration. He served as national security advisor, and Obama called him one of our most outstanding thinkers. So you can look at a lot of different maps of how they imagine the world will be divided up, right? And frankly, I don't think they even have determined for themselves yet how this is all ultimately going to shake out. Right? Here you see North America, South America, you see Eurasia, part of Africa, Northern Africa, Islamic Northern Africa, kind of joining forces with other parts of the Middle East. There is a big effort to create a Middle East Union. We'll talk about that. You see Europe united. Of course, you see Southeast Asia there, right, which is actually coming together right now. ASEAN, I mentioned it, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. You've got India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, Afghanistan, some of these other countries in what's called the SARC, right, the South Asian Association, or a regional government. Here's another map of what it might look like. You've got the OAS, and these are real organizations, right? You've got the OAS, the Organization of American States. You've got the African Union. You've got the Council of Europe, and of course, the European Union. You've got the Pacific Islands Forum, which is very active. You've got the Asia Cooperation Dialogue. Here's another one. And I didn't make these maps, by the way. I just pulled these off the internet. Here you see again, right, some of these different regional groupings that are emerging. You've got the Commonwealth of Independent States there covering Russia and a lot of Central Asia. You've got Africa divided up into these kind of sub-regional units. And we'll talk about that as we get further in, if time permits. You've got Latin America being divided up into these regional governments and so on. Here you have another example of where this is looking to go. And again, these are all regional governments that already exist, right? You got NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the military arm of this kind of new world order. You've got the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement or Organization, which brings in communist China and Russia and Iran and some of these very, very significant governments. So these are all existing organizations, right? And here's a little chart with the five levels of economic integration. I didn't make this. This comes out of a 2012 study. And, the first and most basic, it starts just with free trade between members, right? And we'll get into how free trade is used to bring these about. Then you go to common external tariffs, right? Then you go to factors of production move freely between members. Then you go to common currency, where you have harmonized tax rates, common monetary and fiscal policy. And then last, you have common government. In other words, a government that is above nation states. And so let's talk about how free trade fits into this, right? Because almost all of these began as free trade agreements. Same happened in North America, Europe, everywhere. They start off by selling us this idea of a free trade agreement, and then those very rapidly morph into governments, as we will see. Okay, so we'll start talking about the European Union, right? Here's this interesting, right? You've got these historic drawings of the Tower of Babel right here by Bruegel on the left here, you see. And then you have two different artworks. One, this is actually an official poster of the European Union, right? It says, Europe, many tongues, one voice. Tower of Babel. Very interesting. And then here on the right, you've got the EU Parliament in Strasbourg, which, of course, was designed to look like that on purpose. Okay. So let's talk about the European Union, which is the premier example for these people. It is a cautionary tale. And again, it all started very simply in the aftermath of World War II. Right? If we go back to look at what Lincoln Bloomfield said, war is the most effective catalyst for moving this forward. They created the European Coal and Steel Community. And as all they said was it was six governments in the beginning. It was Germany and France and the Benelux countries, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg. They said, we're just going to pool our resources together when it comes to coal and steel, because hopefully that'll make it harder for us to fight. And so we're just going to create this little baby international organization that will oversee coal and steel within Europe. Well, that morphed into the European Free Trade Agreement. And now the EU basically dominates the lives of Europeans. The former Soviet dictator Mikhail Gorbachev, back in the year 2000, he was visiting Britain, called the European Union the new European Soviet. And I wonder if it was a slip of the tongue. But over the decades, the EU really has morphed into a kind of Soviet. From the European Free Trade Agreement, it became the European Economic Community, and then the European Community. And then finally, it became the European Union, which we know today. And by 2012, right, when we were talking over a decade ago, the head of the European Union, the EU president, they like to call themselves the president of Europe, José Manuel Barroso, and literally a former Maoist revolutionary, said in public, we will need to move toward a federation. This is our political horizon. Federation, of course, means a federal government. Today, the European Union has its own currency. It has its own law enforcement agency. It's now working on building its own military, has its own parliament, which is, of course, a rubber stamp parliament. Right? It's not like a traditional legislature like we think of. But believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, the regime in Brussels, the European Union government, has more power over its constituent parts, over its member states, than the federal government has here in the United States. The EU can literally veto a budget, right? If Germany's parliament, if their elected legislature, the Bundestag, decides to pass a budget that the EU doesn't like, that the EU doesn't approve of, they can veto that budget and force the people's government, the elected government, to go back to the drawing board. Okay. Imagine if the federal government said to Florida, now you can't pass that state budget. Sorry, we don't like it. So, folks, this is very, very dangerous, and it's happening very, very rapidly. This monstrosity called the European Union has actually been opposed by citizens almost every time they've been given the opportunity. Right, I was living in Europe when they asked the French and the Dutch to vote on the Constitution. They asked the Irish to vote on the Constitution. It doesn't matter how many times people vote against this stuff, they just do it anyway. Sometimes they'll just rename it to say, oh, it's not the Constitution. Now it's just the Treaty of whatever. So they've been doing this over and over again. Over 90% of the laws that govern Europe today actually come out of Brussels, right? Not from elected parliaments, not from nation states, but from this regional regime. And again, it is already drastically more powerful than even the federal government. It claims the ability to censor speech, claims the ability to dominate the national governments that make it up. It's truly incredible. If you go back and look at the history of how this situation came about, I actually co-wrote a book about this many years ago with a guy who describes himself as a globalist. He believes in global government. He just doesn't like one run by the totalitarians who are pushing this one. Okay, and I naturally disagree with him on the idea of globalism. I'm a globalist in the sense that I want Jesus Christ to rule and reign over the whole world, and I'll look forward to that. But in the meantime, this I regard thoroughly as a satanic project. But there was a 1950 declassified memo by the head of the Office of Strategic Services that was the precursor to the CIA, the head there, Mr. Donovan, and it outlined a plan to create a European Parliament, which, of course, we now have. A 1965 declassified CIA memo called on the vice president of the European Community to pursue a single currency and to impose it on the nations of Europe. And, of course, we know that as the euro today. You know, if you go back and you look at the Marshall Plan in the aftermath of World War II, one of the big conditions for the European governments, if they wanted our tax money, was that they must jump on the bandwagon and surrender their sovereignty and create a union. And the idea was, and they discussed this very openly in Congress, they understood that the nations of Europe would not want to unite with the United States because we would overpower them. So they said, let's get them all integrated into a European government, and then we can merge those together and create an Atlantic Union, which they thought would be the nucleus for a one-world government. The Bilderberg organization has been very active in this. In fact, the chairman of the Bilderberg, he gave a very interesting comment in the BBC, where he admitted that EU was really a project of Bilderberg, that they helped create the euro. He said to the BBC in 2005 that when you go there, you automatically have globalists or internationalists around you. And again, the EU is already becoming extremely totalitarian. They are censoring. They've got an intelligence agency. They are using every possible pretext to control people. Now they want to ration energy across the continent. In the interest of time, we'll skip that. And now they're interested in exporting this around the world. I want to show you a couple speeches. This man here, a key leader in the EU. He was the head of the European Parliament for a long time, Guy Verhofstadt, a big player in Belgium. But listen to what he says.
On a world level, I think it's absolutely necessary that we go in the direction of a network of regional organizations. We have the European Union in Europe. Maybe tomorrow in Asia, they shall create an Asian currency unit, like we have the Economic and Monetary Union in Europe. There is certainly also an enormous intense cooperation more and more in Latin America. There are the Arab countries. So I see a world order in the future with a multipolar world order, where you see a few big regional subcontinental organizations were important. So the network of these organizations, that is maybe the future for this world.
Wow. Now, doesn't that sound like, oh, yeah, Henry Kissinger? We're going to create regional orders and then relate them to one another in a network of regional orders. I mean, these people are just so transparent, folks, and this should be on the front page of every paper. Here is, at the time, the foreign minister of the European Union, Federica Mogherini. She's Italian. Listen to this.
Our cooperation with our friends and partners around the world is based mainly on this, on trying to support and encourage regional integration and partnerships. That is true in the Arab world and the Middle East. That is true for Africa with the African Union, but also with the G5 Sahel. This is true in Asia with the ASEAN or in Latin America with CELAC. The European Union can pivot a global network of regional alliances. A new global order can benefit immensely from improved regional cooperation in terms of security and in terms of narrative on building this multilateral new global order.
Wow. Pretty clear, right? I mean, they're just like telling you, right? It's not enough to just get rid of sovereignty in Europe. They're going to now do this around the world, and the EU taxpayers are going to be conscripted in this. Obviously, the mass immigration is a big part of this. They're trying to shift people around and kind of undermine national identities. I was in Budapest a few years ago in Hungary, went to the prime minister's office, had some very nice chats with the folks there, and did an interview with their secretary of state, Zoltán Kovács. We spent about 30 minutes together. And I want to share with you what he said. I mean, they're just openly, and of course, they in Hungary oppose this idea, but he's just telling you where they're going with this. Watch.
Labor, what do you think?
Maybe some elements are based on the need for labor and the workforce coming from non-European countries, but definitely there's a political agenda which is trying to change the very nature, the very face of Europe. And that is, there is an agenda, there's a political project called the United States of Europe, which would like to homogenize Europe and get rid of the very foundations of Europe, which is partly Christianity as religion and culture, and the nation state or nations as local communities.
So there you go. Right. The Secretary of State for Hungary telling you there is a project called the United States of Europe where they want to get rid of the foundations of Europe, which is Christianity and the nation state. Right there. Okay. And of course, it's happening here, right, in North America. NAFTA, of course, was one of the big ones. Henry Kissinger actually called it the, and I'm quoting here from his comments, I think it was in the LA Times, the most creative step toward a new world order taken by any group of countries since the Cold War. And so, folks, just like in Europe, these free trade agreements, North American Free Trade Agreement is NAFTA, are serving as the foundation for this agenda. NAFTA created North American courts, which, by the way, have already overruled our state and our federal courts, our legislature. We have some interesting stuff coming out from WikiLeaks. Now, this whole project actually came out of the Council on Foreign Relations. The architect was a guy called Robert Pastor. He was a key individual at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was working on what he described as a North American community. He actually, in his book, attacked the John Birch Society and the Eagle Forum, Phyllis Schlafly's organization, for stopping his precious plans. But, of course, these people don't rest, right? Now, I mentioned Donald Trump. As much as he has spoken out against these so-called free trade agreements, he's condemned multilateral agreements that infringe on our sovereignty. He, I believe, was duped into actually deepening NAFTA. It's a horrible story. If you look at the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada trade agreement that he signed on to, this actually is even worse than NAFTA. It expands the jurisdiction of these North American tribunals and bureaucracies over drastically more areas of law. It enshrines sexual orientation and gender identity. It basically is NAFTA on steroids, ladies and gentlemen. And so you're probably not surprised to know that the architect of that was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a bunch of Obama holdovers, the key guy being Robert Lighthizer, a CFR member. So very, very dangerous, folks. Very, very dangerous. And, you know, Trump made a big show of getting rid of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I'm glad that he did. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible thing. But when he did that, they incorporated a lot of what happened in TPP into the USMCA agreement. And eventually they're planning on a North American union, a North American currency. And they've gotten bolder and bolder about telling you. I could spend, you know, a whole episode of Agenda Weekly talking about this, but I want to go to the president of Mexico at that time, Vicente Fox, admitting on CNN where they're going with this.
Mr. Fox, I'd like to know how you feel about the possibility of having a Latin America united with one currency.
Long term, very long term. What we proposed together, President Bush and myself, it's ALCA, which is a trade union for all of the Americas.
Okay, a trade union for all the Americas. Are you seeing how this goes? And here he is, a little more.
Is it going to be like the euro dollar, you mean?
Well, that would be long, long term. I think the process is to go first step into a trading agreement, and then further on, a new vision like we're trying to do with NAFTA.
All right, there you go, folks. Right, long term, we're going to have a North American or even a all of the Americas currency. Now, WikiLeaks actually leaked some very important documents on this, including a cable from the U.S. Ambassador Paul Cellucci to Canada. This was, I believe, 2007 that this document was written, and it wasn't leaked till years later. But it openly talks about different ways of getting around national constitutions. It talks about the possibility of an eventual monetary union. It talks about the possibility of a North American parliament. So they're very open, folks. Here's a 1930s map of the North American technate. Very interesting right there. Right? They're telling you openly, right? This is from Nouriel Roubini, a very, very influential economist who served in a lot of prominent positions. This just came out this year in Project Syndicate, a globalist syndicator of columns toward a North American economic union. And he says to resolve their current tensions, Canada, Mexico, and the United States should start drafting plans for a North American economic union. Single market in goods, services, capital, labor, technology, data, and information would benefit all three countries far more than any alternative arrangement. Right, and just like Europe, right, it'll start as an economic union. It'll move rapidly toward a full-blown political union as well. Now, on relating these regional orders to one another, we actually see this process happening as well, right? I mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What that would have done was it would have integrated NAFTA into this broader alliance with 12 other governments, including some brutal dictatorships, that would have created, in effect, a Pacific Union, as Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama put it. He said it would have created a new structure known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership Commission, a Pacific Union, which meets, appoints unelected bureaucrats, adopts rules, and changes the agreement after adoption. It allowed corporations to sue taxpayers in international tribunals. And then on the other coast, they were working on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership that would have started the process of merging the European Union with the United States and creating an Atlantic Union, just like they were talking about in the aftermath of World War II. So folks are very, very advanced on this. Now, they have an African Union that's being imposed on the people of Africa by the communist Chinese, by the U.S. government, by the European Union. It's already got a parliament. It already has a Supreme Court. The Court of Justice has an African military that's been deployed multiple times. They're working on a continental currency. And if you look at the way the African Union is developing, it's actually a microcosm of what they're doing at the global level. They've divided Africa up into multiple sub-regions, and they're creating regional organizations that are usurping the sovereignty of the members. So in Southern Africa, you have the Southern African Development Community. That brings in South Africa, Botswana, Namibia, Zimbabwe, some of these other Southern African countries. You've got the East African Community, the EAC. You've got the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa. So you've got this patchwork of these regional, like sub-regional organizations that all eventually will be merged into a full-blown totalitarian African Union. And once it's done, they're very proud of this. It'll be borderless. They'll have about 600 million people under their thumb, over a trillion of economic activity, all under the unaccountable rule of this thing called an African Union. And if you want to know what that looks like, consider that they put the genocidal Marxist dictator Robert Mugabe as the chairman of the AU before he was overthrown by his own military. So very troubling here, folks. Latin America is filled with these regional governments. UNASUR was one of the big ones. They've got others now. They've got the CELAC, which is the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. You've got the Organization of American States, as I mentioned, that goes across the entire continent, North America, Central America, South America. Vladimir Putin is right now building a Eurasian Economic Union very, very openly. Right? And it's interesting because this war in Ukraine is serving to bolster both the European Union and the Eurasian Union, as they both use the other as an excuse to deepen this. The Eurasian Union includes Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, and other places. And they're eventually hoping to incorporate all of the former Soviet states. And Putin himself has explained what the agenda is here, right? He says eventually they're going to merge the Eurasian Union with the European Union, and they're going to have a harmonized regulatory regime, he says, from Vladivostok to Portugal, right? Truly incredible. But again, this is all in the open, and they say these things openly, right? From Lisbon to Vladivostok, they'll have a free trade zone, and eventually it'll relate with all these others. Now, they're doing the same thing in the Middle East, right? Council on Foreign Relations, here's their article. The EU offers a model for unifying the Middle East. This is written by a former terrorist turned Islamic globalist, and he says, just as warring European continent found peace through unity by creating what became the EU, Arabs, Turks, Kurds, and other groups, by which he means Jews and maybe even Persians, in the region could find relative peace in ever closer union. What could go wrong, right? Here's Frederick Kempe. We met him earlier, CEO of the Atlantic Council. Listen to him talking about this with one of our top elected officials.
This region stirs up emotions. This path to the future, and let's not forget where Europe was up until 1945, before the European Union, before NATO, before all of that. You talked, I think, about Soviet normalization almost in that spirit. And some people have talked about a path of integration that could create economic integration in the Middle East, like the European Union, military integration, not a NATO necessarily, but countries coming closer together. Are we closer to that now, Saudi normalization with Israel, the Abraham Accords leading to something a little bit more far-reaching of the sort that you talked about at the end of your speech? Or are we further away from everything that's happened in the last couple of years?
Look, I believe we're much closer to it. And what we've done over the past 4 years, building on the Abraham Accords, was to try to get to their ultimate realization, which is normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. A lot of work went into that, including, as I described, agreements necessary between.
All right, folks. So there you have it, right? They're doing the same thing down in Oceania. Here is the Prime Minister of New Zealand, bigwig at the UN.
I think in terms of advocacy for the needs of a wide range of states, the regional organizations which exist around our world are very important. We've spoken.
Yeah. So anyways, BRICS, of course, is helping to lead this charge, right? So Brazil will be the anchor of the Latin American or South American regional government. Russia is the anchor of the Eurasian Union. India is the anchor of the South Asian Union. China is the anchor of the East Asian. And then South Africa is, of course, the anchor, the powerhouse, bringing together the African Union. And ultimately, they want to do this even within our country, right? They want to abolish states. One of the key CFR globalist bigwigs actually came out. His name is Parag Khanna, I think. He says, we don't have to create these regions. They already exist. So we've got to abolish the states and move toward regional governments, folks. Now, there are a lot of, I think, scriptural implications to this. God created nations, not regions, right? There are even some people who look at this from a prophetic perspective. They talk about these 10 kings who eventually merge their authority with this one horrific system. But we'll leave the biblical and eschatological implications to others and for another time. For now, we are out of time, but I want to thank you guys so very much for all that you do. Thank you for all that you do and how you follow Agenda Weekly. We are all very grateful. I'm so grateful to Curtis Bowers and all the work that he does. And God willing, we shall see again. I shall see you again next month. So thank you and God bless you.
I hope that was informative and you learned some things that you didn't know. That is something we need to be aware of. A lot of times these things, we don't notice them as a threat because, oh, that's just a regional thing that they're doing here or there. But it's all the necessary framework and foundation for that ultimate world government that they seek. Our verse for this week is Philippians 4:6. Be careful for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. So important. Make sure that you're bringing your burdens and your cares to the Lord. In this world, there's a lot of suffering and tribulation and trials and heartbreak and things. And God's just wanting us to bring those to me with thanksgiving, because we always have so much to be thankful for, regardless of all these different things going on and the lies being told or whatever. We still have so much to be thankful for. But be careful for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. He's listening. He does care. Thank you so much for joining me. And until next week, God bless you.